Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. This week's guest is Professor Donna Ian Davis, a member of the Queens College faculty with an appointment in urban studies and is director of the Center for the Study of Women in Society at the Graduate Center, where she administers the master's program in women's and gender studies. Davis's work covers two broad domains, Black feminist ethnography and the dynamics of race and racism. She is currently co-editor of Transforming Anthropology, the Journal of the Association of Black Anthropologists. She is author of numerous journal articles and book chapters, including editor or co-author of 7 books. Her most recent publication is Reproductive Justice, Racism, Pregnancy, and Premature Birth, NYU Press 2019. Last year, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo appointed Davis to the Governor's Maternal Mortality Task Force. Welcome to The Thought Project, Professor Davis.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on publishing Reproductive Justice. It's a significant contribution of scholarly research during, I think, a period of quite a bit of attention from the journalism world on the high mortality rates of Black women during childbirth. I take note of the ProPublica NPR joint partnership, which was published in 2017. I read it, was completely devastated by it, and then it was followed by this New York Times Magazine piece. And you were writing your book at this time. Were you consulted by either of them?
Actually, I was consulted by Linda Villarosa, who wrote the New York Times article. When the ProPublica piece came out,
yes,
earlier, I was thinking, oh my gosh, no one's going to be interested in my book because it's already been, discussed.
I disagree with that, being what I do for a living. I think what you've done is really, really significant.
Thank you.
So has anybody called you up since, like you're with your book out?
Yes, I have been invited to give talks around the country. I've also been invited to converse on podcasts. I think I've done three.
Yes, I
or
did.
Four.
I did listen to one. I did listen to one.
And there's an area of a domain that I had not anticipated, which is from the medical field. So I've been invited to participate in the development of some measures to address, I guess you could say, obstetric racism, which is what I call it, in the hospital settings in California.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So this is actually a personal thing for me. Women's maternal morbidity in the United States in particular, I would just say a lot of people who know me, I mean, like I talk about this on Facebook. I mean, you know, this is one of my things. So reading your book and what a lot of people are not aware of is that American women experience one of the highest maternal morbidity rates in the Western developed world, and that Black women experience maternal morbidity at even higher rates, with 60% more common among Black women experiencing hypertension and preeclampsia and eclampsia or mini strokes during pregnancy and birthing. You assert that these differences are not about race, but racism. What did your study reveal? I think this is the $1 million question.
It is. So first of all, the reason that I say it's not about race is because race is really the static, socially constructed concept that does not account for the way in which people are treated necessarily. And what my study showed is that Black women have particular experiences with racism, and when they narrate those experiences, for some of us, they may seem to be benign. Their medical encounters may seem to be very benign. But to them, it's the accumulation of those experiences that makes for a disruptive medical encounter. It makes for a medical encounter that makes them unsure. It makes for encounters that they think place them at risk. Essentially, what I found is that Black women have an understanding of the historical ways in which Black bodies have been treated medically, and that they are able to capture some of that treatment in their understanding of how they are dealt with in the contemporary moment. And when I say that it's racism, I mean to say that we need to hold accountable the medical technological complex that has over-medicalized, I believe, pregnancy and childbirth and postpartum issues, that does not necessarily view pregnancy as a natural phenomena, but rather something that is at risk or creates risk, and that Black women in particular are viewed as being a risky body, like the literal bodies
right,
are risky.
Right. I thought your decision to study professional Black women who had higher levels of educational attainment was an interesting choice, and just based upon the review of your book and other literature, you basically have created a controlled group to study, right? Looking at them through a lens. I mean, you're separating out the disadvantages of poverty, and even though they have higher levels of educational attainment and probably are middle class, upper middle class. In other words, how would the medical system respond to these professional women? And, you know, I was, of course, shocked by the ProPublica NPR case with respect to was it her name?
Charity.
Yes. And the very public, but actually, I think, overlooked case of Serena Williams. I mean, mm-hmm. She came back and from really a very serious event. I mean, she had a blood clot. She had preeclampsia. And people were saying, oh, well, you know, maybe she'll never come back. I was like, this woman almost died, right?
She did.
She almost died.
Yeah. So here are some of the things that I think helped us to understand, in fact, what happened to Serena and other people like Kira Johnson, whose mother-in-law is Judge Glenda Hatchett.
Right.
What I think is that, generally speaking, the medical profession perceives itself as being obviously much more capable of making determinations, making clinical decisions. And they don't really trust or listen to people who actually have probably a very intuitive sense of their bodies. They often get dismissed. And that's exactly what happened with Serena. She knew her body.
Right.
And they didn't listen to her.
And she spoke up. And she persisted, correct?
And she persisted.
Yes.
Some of the women that I've spoken with since I've finished the book, as well as some that I spoke with for the book, have talked about what it feels like to have a sense that something is wrong, but to have the presence of their physical being be used in judgment about what it is they may be experiencing. So, for example, in the book I talk about one woman who was aware of the fact that she had high blood pressure, but her doctors perceived her as being, as she put it, a young Black girl on aid, and decided that she was working in an environment where she was standing constantly and that was contributing to her high blood pressure.
Sure.
And she knew that that was not the case. So the choice to interview women who were educated and typically had access to resources was actually serendipitous.
Is this your own personal experience as well, looking at it? But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, in the beginning of the book, I talk about what my experience was like when I was pregnant a very long time ago.
Right.
And knowing that or feeling that the doctors that I was addressing or that who were dealing with my my pregnancy needs were evaluating me based on the fact that I was a Black woman. But the choice to focus on women with higher levels of education was serendipitous. I did, in fact, try very hard to talk to women across economic status. And it turned out that it was mostly women who were professionals that contacted me. And then it later turned out that when I was doing more of a literature review to see what studies showed about middle class and educated Black women, it was apparent that that's not a population that the medical field is interested in. Why not? It turns out that often, not always, obstetrics and gynecology residents are often learning their craft, if you will, on the bodies of poor women, people who were receiving public assistance.
Right.
And so then the kind of clinical decisions that they make are often rooted in that combination of race and class in a public hospital setting.
Right.
But it also means that they're, in some ways, maybe they're believing that people don't know their bodies and that, you know, poor people are destructive. And I think I use this term frequently in the book, that low-income and poor Black women have become a mascot of adverse birth outcomes. And I think that that's incorrect. I'm not suggesting that people who are poor and low-income don't have adverse birth outcomes. But that cannot be the only factor when we look at data that shows that women with higher degrees of education have similar or worse outcomes. So trying to account for that is where I ended up trying to think about if it's not class, which is what a lot of the medical profession wants to put forward.
Right.
Then what does racism feel like and look like in a medical encounter to the people that experience it? And that, I think, is what's fundamentally important about this book. I cared about how people feel racism is articulated in their experiences.
Thank you for sharing that. The person I was referring to was Shalon Irving, who was the public health—
Yeah, right. She was an epidemiologist.
She was an epidemiologist at the CDC. I mean, it's just...
And a classic case in her instance where she kept going back to the doctor because she knew something was wrong. But they somehow decided that it was, you know, a sort of unimportant set of circumstances that she was experiencing, and they did not pursue an appropriate intervention, which I find fascinating because... Right, the medical profession often views intervention as the dominant strategy for addressing health concerns, right?
Right.
But when people want an intervention, they're being, and often, and many times, dismissed.
Dismissed.
And that's exactly what happened with Kira Johnson.
I'll just say personally that I chose a long time ago to go to women obstetricians, I mean, to gynecologists, because... Men were very dismissive in the way they treated you. So just as a woman, and then I'm not a Black woman, so this is so disturbing and heartbreaking, I would just add.
Yeah. I do want to say that the thing about a system is that anybody can be an actant in that system. And so there are female or OBGYNs that identify as women who are just as dismissive
as
others because they're trained in the same system.
Right.
And I think it takes a lot of guts
to really push
against it and to really treat people like people and listen to what their concerns are. As a doula, which I am also.
Oh, you are?
Yes, I am also a doula. So I also see what the medical interactions are like. And every woman that I have serviced as a doula has had a female OBGYN. And sometimes it doesn't work out very well.
I see. Fair enough. you begin the book on prematurity of Black women's babies mm-hmm. with a historical review. And what did this unique history of Black women birthing babies prematurely reveal to you? Because we know it's connected to slavery, the history of slavery in women's bodies.
So I'll just say that I think one of the most startling, I think, and important things that I discovered was when historical economists, or when an historical economist, identified or put together a chart that showed Black infant mortality rates compared to white infant mortality rates from the 1800s to 2000. And this particular chart was put together by a professor, Michael Haynes, who, if I'm not mistaken, is at Colgate University. And when he constructed this comparative analysis, what we see is that starting in 1850, we can begin to capture infant mortality rates by race. And infant mortality is important because that's the usual consequence of a premature birth. So the Black-white difference in 1850, so we're talking in the, during enslavement in the United States.
Right.
The Black-white difference was 1.5 times more likely to die than a white infant. By the year 2000, according to his chart, it was about 2.5 times. So while the numbers decreased,
uh-huh.
the difference between the Black-white ratio
mm-hmm.
increased. So what that tells me, because I use the afterlife of slavery concept to think about the continuity of the experience mm-hmm. of adverse birth outcomes, what that tells me is that there is an afterlife of slavery, that things that existed during enslavement can be captured in contemporary sets of experiences. We see it with birth outcomes. We see it with incarceration. We see it with lack of access to resources. We can see it with, there's an afterlife of slavery in terms of the agricultural production and loss of farmland. So we see an afterlife of slavery in a lot of domains of life. So that was, I think, one of the most important and startling historical pieces of information that I discovered.
You said that you were surprised by, women contacting you in your— Was that the biggest surprise that you got out of the book, or are there other discoveries from the book? I mean, for example, putting this economic historical data mm-hmm. in and seeing the progression of babies dying is just, that's really, really quite a damnation mm-hmm. of structural racism in America.
I would have to say that I think each chapter in the book has its own version of a surprise. So there's the chapter that has that chart. Then there's another chapter that talks about, it's a particular woman's experience, Yvette Santana. I think there are lots of surprises in that chapter, things that I thought I didn't expect to find. I did not expect, for example, for her to say this, to make a comment that I think is one of the headings in that chapter, where she said, if I were a white woman with blonde hair, I would have two children instead of one. And she attributed the loss of one of her children, both of whom, she had twins. She attributed that to racism. She believes that her children were treated differentially because they were Black and brown.
And what about the NICU chapter?
The NICU chapter, actually, that's a chapter. I love each chapter for different reasons, but I love that chapter because in that chapter there are three people whose stories get told in great detail.
Yes,
and two of them indicated that they didn't have the experience of racism when their children were in the neonatal intensive care unit, and I like the fact that people talked about that they didn't have a sense of racism. And in both of those instances, family members were part of the medical field, and so maybe it made sense. But I thought it was important to include them because while they may not have experienced racism, that doesn't mean racism isn't circulating in the, you know, in the medical technological complex. So it was surprising to construct that particular chapter around the experiences of two people who did not experience racism and one person who did. In other chapters, I think what I found surprising, there's a chapter that talks about saving.
Yeah, saving the babies.
Saving the babies, where yeah. I simply try to chronicle the different forms of saving, be it through programmatic interventions, be it through legislation, be it through the development of technology. And that particular chapter was precipitated by a Time magazine article that came out, the front of which had a young child, an infant, who's attached to all of these tubes. And it's talking about the incredible success of neonatal intensive care. The child was in Milwaukee, which, by the way, has one of the largest infant mortality rates in the country. But at the end of that chapter, I talk about how nurses felt about working with premature infants. And each of the NICU nurses, in one form or another, asked this question, what are we doing? They were not suggesting that they don't do their jobs and that they don't care about the kids that they're taking care of. But they were questioning all of the interventions that get used. And they were concerned about this concept of saving, which to them meant that there were going to be a lot of interventions that sometimes hurt babies. They could, you know, babies
right.
feel.
Sure.
And then oftentimes, not always, many of the nurses indicated that they get to see these little people grow up in the communities because they sometimes live nearby. And there was a kind of sadness about some of the outcomes of premature birth and what some of the outcomes of interventions mm-hmm. result in. And I found that surprising, that they were not as not that they weren't as invested, but that they questioned the concept of saving. I was very surprised at that. And then
so the experience stays with them as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Obviously. Yes.
Absolutely.
They walk around with that experience.
Yeah. And they're taking care of the, you know, these little neonates much longer than the neonatologists are. They're
right.
with them for longer shifts. They grow attached. You know, and they're watching them have machines and all kinds of things attached to their bodies.
Right.
And they're, you know, they have a deep sense of concern about what it feels like for the baby and what some of the consequences will be. I think I'd read one story of these two women who were nurses, who were neonatal intensive care unit nurses. They were sisters. They were twins. And they were born prematurely. And they had gotten so many needle stick pricks in the bottom of their feet that their feet actually were numb as adults. And they talked about the memory of that and then how they didn't like doing needle, you know, pricks on
to the babies
that they were taking care of.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you're quite an advocate, and I didn't realize that you yourself are a doula. And you, one of the chapters is like narrowing the gap of Black women's burdens, and you also address that maybe we need to take it out of the hospital. And you have other remedies that you discuss. And tell me what you think should be done about taking pregnancy and birthing out of the hospital.
It's not that I think that there should be no births in hospitals.
Right.
What I think is that there needs to be more options. If we put as much effort into sharing with the population that they can have different kinds of birthing experiences, then that opens up, I think, the possibility for shifting the hypermedicalization of pregnancy and care. So some of the things that I talk about are as follows. I think that we need to have more birthing centers. I've often said that I think we should have a birthing center at the same ratio as we have post offices. We need to have greater reimbursement, insurance reimbursement.
Right.
If we're going to stay with an insurance system, then I would argue that the reimbursement rates for a hospital birth that does not have a risk, a home birth, and a birthing center birth should all be the same. And then if we did that, we'd begin to equalize the groups of people that can participate in the birthing field. And we know that home-based births can, in fact, be very, very safe when there's no risk factor.
Right.
I think that there absolutely needs to be a greater investment in the provision of doula services. And I think that doulas and midwives could be working in greater
numbers
mm-hmm. and also, you know, in terms of complementing each other's skill sets. I think that hospitals should consider allowing midwives to
be in the hospital
Not just be in a hospital setting, but uh-huh. also to not necessarily to be affiliated with the hospital, uh-huh. but to be able to get space, which is something actually that they do, if I'm not mistaken, in Germany. I'm not 100% sure about that,
right.
but I have heard that that's the case.
You do make the point that there are patient advocates and that Black women more times than not don't get to meet that person until maybe they're in the birthing process.
And sometimes that's true, and part of it is due to cost. So there's some tensions, I think, around when I say patient advocates. I mean, I am speaking specifically of doulas because mm-hmm. that's what we do. But there's some tension around creating a tier of laborers who are going to be at the low end of the scale.
Right.
And some of the tensions are that, first of all, doctors don't listen to doulas. We're not medically trained.
Right.
So the interventions that we can offer are really very minimal. But the reason that I think we need to have a greater integration of doula work is so that we don't create this
hierarchical
tiered labor, segmented labor within the field. It already exists.
Right.
But when a state like New York decides that they want to have Medicaid reimbursement for doula services because they think that doula services are going to help reduce the right. adverse birth outcome, that in fact may be true, but they are not necessarily addressing the fact that racism is still going to be circulating
right.
in the medical field.
Right.
And if we agree that racism is a problem in medicine, then having doulas is not going to solve that problem.
Of course. But it's clear that your public anthropology has been recognized because Governor Cuomo named you to the Maternity Mortality Task Force. So I have to ask you, did you give him a copy of your book, and did you give one to each person on the task force?
I did not, because when I was on the task force, the book wasn't out yet.
Oh.
The book came out afterwards.
I see.
But I was invited to be on that task force because people had both read my comments
sure.
in the New York Times.
Right.
And, you know, maybe I should have sent him the book.
No, you should. You should do it now. You should send it
okay.
to the governor. I recommend it. I recommend it. You send it to each a member of the task force. Your last chapter, you end with radical Black birth workers, and you've been talking about that. And is there anything beyond what you're talking about in terms of I think the idea of leveling the hierarchy and, you know, having community-based birthing centers would be a significant step forward, it
yeah.
would seem, in care.
Yeah. I think it's important to recognize the historical ways in which Black women have provided care for the Black community and beyond, especially when care was truncated. So during segregation, it was Black women who oftentimes who did provide care.
Right.
And we saw the development of you know, separate hospitals. I think, though, the demonization, the intensive demonization of midwifery in the United States is partly what helped to elevate OBGYN care or services. And
it was a denigration of women's role.
It was a denigration of women's role, but it really did harm Black, what they call grand midwives, I think, to a far greater degree. And we can look at that. If we like to look at statistics, we'll note that Black women currently make up somewhere between two and no more than 5% of all midwives, whether they're practicing midwives or certified nurse midwives or licensed.
It's really, really marginal.
And that's a really small number.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what are the ways in which we can open up that space? I would argue that it's likely that the certifying entities for midwifery mm-hmm. are not making it as easy for Black women to become part of that, you know, illustrious group of people who provide care. And so we need to make sure that there are more pathways.
Open it up.
Becoming midwives and not create the same kind of exclusive entry that we have for the medical profession.
Right.
Or else we will simply replicate the same kind of hierarchy that currently exists.
And probably the same kind of care. I have to say, before you go, I have to ask a Trump question. my God, it's really, this is where we are. And he has taken hostage of all women's bodies. And you make a fair point in your recent article, Trump Race and Reproduction in the Afterlife of Slavery, that there are particular reproductive issues facing Black and brown women at this moment, in mm-hmm. this Trump moment of hostage taking.
Yeah, in that article, I was really trying to get at, while we are constantly shocked, angered, and decimated by what Trump does, there's a history that precedes Trump.
Without a doubt.
Right?
Right.
It precedes Trump. Both the control of women's bodies and the denigration of women's bodies, and I would argue birthing people's bodies, has a much longer history that goes back to Aristotle, who I don't talk about in that article. But it feels anew because we did think that we had reached a point where the body was understood as belonging to the individual. That it had agency.
Integrity.
And, you know, but the body is a community domain in many ways. And there are particular communities that don't like particular bodies. And there are ways in which particular bodies continue to be tormented and tortured and, you know, reproductive injustice is not only about the inaccessibility, for example, of abortion. It's not only about this ridiculous reimplantation
of an ectopic pregnancy. Yes.
It's also about the water source in Detroit. It's also about the fact that, you know, that people are not going to be able to get food because there's a reduction in SNAP.
Yes.
So there's really an assault that I think on being a human mm-hmm. and in the United States that has just been exacerbated by his presidency. And I don't know that we can afford to fight this fight narrowly on issues of reproduction and reimplantation of ectopic pregnancies.
Right.
I think there might need to be a much broader. That's what reproductive justice is. That right? According to my heroine Loretta Ross.
I have known Loretta since the 80s. Did a lot of work with her a long time ago.
We need to be focused on a broader justice organizing, so that we can integrate all of these very important issues that. Really, if we don't attend to them, there's just this little chipping away. It's a big chipping away.
On the edges.
That will get to the middle. You know, we're standing in the middle. Particular bodies are on the edges, but generally we're standing in the middle. And as they chip away at the edges, it comes to us in any form. And I think the control that he has exerted, it's remarkable.
How quickly?
It's not only how quickly, it's remarkable how much segments of our society think that it's okay.
That's true. I agree completely. I happen to be a human rights professor and been doing this contemporary human rights course at Hunter on LGBTQ lives. And in the review of the UN Universal Periodic Reviews of each country in Geneva, one thing, though, is very clear, that women and children are oppressed around the world, in every country, in every single country. And we're also witnessing, like in Latin America, in Chile right now, the uprising and the fierce resistance of women to rape there and of the killings of women throughout the Caribbean and Latin America. It was like about 3,500 mm-hmm. women in this past year. It is a really viscerally difficult time. There's just a visceral reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump is emblematic of what is more broadly present.
As one of my students said recently, white patriarchy runs deep.
Yes, and white supremacy is hand mm-hmm. in hand. I want to thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into The Thought Project, and thanks to today's guest, Professor Donna Ian Davis of Queen's College and the Graduate Center, CUNY. The Thought Project is brought to you with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Kevin Wolf of CUNY TV. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.